So welcome back to part two of the Queen Charlotte recap.
A
Bridgerton story.
Which is why it's relevant to us, apparently. And, you know, Legends and Lattes isn't, but we'll get onto that later.
Oh my gosh. So we are recapping Charlotte's story, Lady Danbury's story, and Violet Bridgerton's story here at Regency Rumors. And we are excited that you are here with us. Do the intro yet again.
Yeah. Welcome, listeners, one and all.
Yeah, that one.
Oh, that one. Okay. Welcome, listeners, one and all. Welcome to Regency Rumors, the podcast / YouTube show where we, a British-American couple, recap and discuss Bridgerton and Netflix Regency show, or in this case, Queen Charlotte, a Bridgerton story. This is episode two. I've got some weird pauses in there, which my wife will have to edit out.
Oh.
Welcome to the second episode. We went a little bit long on the first one. We apologize for that, but also I'm sure that in some ways that's also a good thing because there's a lot to talk about and it's an interesting show, I think.
So, and there's six episodes. So yeah, there's a lot to discuss.
Yep.
So
six episodes of the TV show, not of this.
No.
We are finished. This is after the fact.
If you have been enjoying our recap, please like and subscribe and comment. Is that the other thing that people do on YouTube? We're new. And if you're listening, then give us a review and keep listening.
Oh, dear. Share, maybe.
Yes, share if you like it. Join our Facebook group where I post articles about Bridgerton. Facebook.com/groups/Regency Rumors.
With a U.
Now on to the recap.
Onwards. So, the second kind of major storyline in Queen Charlotte was that of Lady Danbury's.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting to see Lady Danbury as a young woman. I think that characters like Queen Charlotte, like Lady Danbury, and to some extent Violet, because they are older women and they are seen as these, you know, wise, older characters, there's something almost like mystifying about it. It's kind of like we don't really truly know that. They just come in and they say wise words and then they leave.
Yeah.
You know, and so I thought this was really interesting to have the main storyline be the three of them and to show their past a bit more intimately, so that we see that they're people, they had love lives, they had difficulties like anybody else. And so the reason why they're able to impart this wisdom to these younger characters in Bridgerton is because they have lived a life themselves. And so often, especially in the hero's journey, the mentor character, we don't really get to know what their background is. We just know that they're wise and they're old.
Yes.
And so it's nice, it was nice to see that they actually had a backstory. And I thought that the actress who played younger Lady Danbury did a really good job. And she also had kind of a learning role like Charlotte did in learning how to navigate society, especially as a woman of color.
But it seems to me anyway that Lady Danbury is in her early 20s at that time period.
Maybe. We're not really told.
We're not told. Yeah. No, we're not. So, and then Charlotte's 17, and then so Violet then is
probably about 12.
13-ish,
yeah,
I would
12,
say.
13, yeah.
It's interesting, yeah. Anyway, the different age range between the characters and how they interact, particularly when they're older, because obviously when you've got a 17-year-old who suddenly becomes queen, it's a jump in power. It's quite difficult to deal with.
Well, and you were talking about King George letting these doctors have authority over his life. We see that with Queen Charlotte, with Lady Danbury, and in some ways her mother-in-law. But there are times that she lets Lady Danbury go off on her and say, "What are you doing? I'm going to speak freely." Has very bold statements for the way that Charlotte is choosing to start her reign, essentially. And I found that really interesting. Yeah. Clearly, Charlotte, at a younger age, saw Lady Danbury as a bit of a slightly older mentor, even yes. though Lady Danbury was going through her own changes and her own journey. So
I think
I liked that. I liked seeing the different scenes of them in their individual stories.
Yes, because I think Violet is always placed in a position of innocence in the show. So Lady Danbury, though, has a quite an interesting progression from being the wife of a slightly eccentric gent.
There's a lot of words for her her husband, I feel like. I definitely think they wanted that effect of, like, disheveled older man who doesn't really take care of himself, but he's kind of bumbling and he wants to be seen more seriously in society, but he doesn't have the kind of emotional maturity to see that any of the problems are within himself. So, like, when he keeps saying, like, Lady Danbury would do something, and then he'd be like, they see me for who I truly am.
And she would say, we are here. And he said, yes, I am finally here.
Yes.
It was just like, that's a joke, right? Like, we are supposed to be laughing at that.
But I think he took it seriously. I think they want us to think that the character took his life very seriously, and then she was having a hard time taking him seriously because he had no internal introspective abilities, really.
Lady Danbury's story explained how she became Lady Danbury. This was very early on in the series where, because the Tun had a very traditional, I guess, approach to aristocracy, the Princess Dowager, the king's mother, realized we need more people of color in the court, at the wedding, etc., etc. They called it the Great Experiment throughout the show. The elevation of Lord and Lady Danbury to the nobility, it was kind of done almost on a whim. They were just like, hey, let's get these people into the court and see how it goes, but it'll make the wedding look fine. Then later on, Lord Danbury popping his clogs, shuffling off the mortal coil, becoming an ex-Lord Danbury. That obviously set into motion a few other things for Lady Danbury and then the other families of colour that had been elevated and were then worried that they were going to have their titles taken from them. And that would have been a very real problem, because the crown at many times in history has given titles to people that are not hereditary. So without getting that, basically, as if your title isn't hereditary, it goes away after a generation. And they didn't want that. And I think that is where, earlier we were talking about a more serious show, that is another aspect where it came in. So with Queen Charlotte, obviously the serious of the kind of the darker, serious nature of the show came through in King George's health and their relationship. So with Lady Danbury, it is in the diversity of the aristocracy and then whether or not they were able to keep hold of the titles that the Princess Dowager gave them.
I mean, the sad part of this is obviously that is all fabricated. That wouldn't have even been a storyline. That the truth is so much more darker, the way people of color would have been able to move within society. We have representations like Sanditon, where people of color being heiresses from foreign lands. So it's not that people of color weren't able to be in these upper circles, but they were not as common. And all of the things that were happening at the time with slavery and colonization is so much darker than what this show portrays. So this was kind of a way to be able to show some aspects of that, but in a lighter way, because obviously Bridgerton is a lighter show. Had they portrayed the real truth of how people of color would have been treated in upper circles, then it would have been a different show. And so this was a way to, the Great Experiment was a very surface level way to talk about race and the unfairness of the time, but without kind of it getting too dark. I think that that's hard. I think there are some people that criticize Bridgerton and see the kind of downside of not covering these things more thoroughly. I feel like there's also a lot of people that want to be able to watch shows like Bridgerton that are a lot lighter, where they can see people like themselves in a show, where they can see people of color in these upper circles as princesses, as queens, in Western society. And Bridgerton is this very fun and light way of being able to do that and still explore some of these storylines. But it is, you know, it is.
I mean,
at surface level.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, basically, I saw a tweet that put it quite well, is just that black people deserve escapism too.
Yeah.
And that's you know, it's a good way of doing it, is by having the characters not historically correct, in inverted commas. But that's another debate, because we know that there are potentially issues with the historical record and with the interpretation of said historical record. And again, I'm not a historian, so I won't go into that too much today. One of the notes that you put in the discussion notes was about how Lady Danbury and her son kind of interacted. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and your thoughts there?
Yeah, I feel like that was kind of one of the negatives, in my opinion, of Lady Danbury's character when she's younger. On the whole, Lady Danbury is this really vivacious character. She's having to deal with things all on her own. I think that's the other thing. These women are all three on their own. They're all single and they're all having to deal with being single on their own. But especially Lady Danbury when she's younger, even her having a husband, she's dealing with a lot of things on her own. And so when he dies, she's really alone, and here she is having to navigate society, and now she has a young son that she's hoping she can kind of get out into the world and continue on her family name. I think the thing I didn't like about this character when she's younger is that her son is being used essentially as a pawn. We don't you don't see her child whatsoever throughout the series, and then the only time he's brought out is when she's like, oh, look, I have a kid. Isn't he beautiful? Give me a title.
Well, there's two scenes. We do see there is a scene where she's in the garden and she's watching the nanny play with the two children.
Yeah.
That's it.
yeah. I feel like, you know, it's not a requirement that Lady Danbury has to be all huggy, lovey-dovey. You know, she doesn't have to be counter to what her disposition is as an older character. But I feel like she's missing some depth in her younger character, to have her kind of use her son as a pawn and then be like, okay, we're never going to show that she has any other kids again. It's not important to show that she has kids or that she loves her kids or whatever. And so, and because yeah. We see Lady Danbury as an adult in Bridgerton give advice to these younger people with such warmth and wisdom and love, it's hard to watch her as a younger person just be like, ew, I have kids. Well, so I don't know.
What does she say at one point? So in one of the current day scenes, when the Queen, Lady Danbury, and then Violet are there in the greenhouse, whatever it is, conservatory, Lady Danbury says something along the lines of, I have the fortune of my children all moving continents away, type thing, so I don't have to deal with them. And so clearly she's not that close to them, but I think you can argue that that's part of the character and the, as Lady Danbury puts it, the loathing that she had for Lord Danbury. She was forced into that position. She was effectively raised to be his wife, and so the children are a part of that. It's a reminder every day, I presume, that she was brought up for one reason, and that reason was to be this man's bride. And that's something she wanted to get away from. She wanted to define herself through her own story, her own purpose and meaning. And so obviously being a mother would be potentially difficult to slot into that new worldview.
I don't know. You know, we were talking about this yesterday. I don't necessarily think a bad thing to have a character who's like this, or like, oh, my children. You know, I think it's more of how it's done. So to me, I was saying one of the who does a great job of writing older women is Julian Fellowes with Downton Abbey. I think that there is a way to write these women that have, you know, these very witty, cutting lines that can show these aspects of their characters without it being so overt. I feel like some of, you know, Lady Danbury's disdain for her husband or her kids, it's not that it shouldn't be there necessarily. It's more that it's written so overtly that it makes us feel like we maybe like her character a bit less. At least that's what I felt like. Whereas I feel like if somebody like Julian Fellowes had written a character like Lady Danbury, there would have been so much more nuance in some of the things that she says, because with a character like Maggie Smith's in Downton Abbey, there are those aspects of her character. Sometimes she isn't as fond of her children. Sometimes we get these little kind of notions that she had a love life when she was younger and maybe she was a bit scandalous. But there's also moments where she's very gentle and kind to her family members, but she doles them out very sparingly, and they're always at the right times, and they're always very impactful. While Bridgerton attempts to do that, and at times Lady Danbury has had some great lines as an older person, I feel like sometimes they are so overt, and especially seeing her life as a younger person where she's just like, ugh, don't like my husband and don't like my kids, and she's like celebrating that he's, you know, the moment that he dies like that, so overtly. I'm not.
Which was also gross. Let's just put it out there.
Oh gosh, how he died. Yeah. I'm not saying that she couldn't feel these things, especially for, like you said, she had to be raised to be his wife and then she didn't really love him. There was kind of probably mental and physical abuse throughout their marriage. So I'm not saying that she had to feel kind of like, you know, terribly sad that he died or things. I just think it could have been done in a different way that wasn't so overt. And, you know, I had a bit of a problem with her character sometimes when she was younger, that some of those strong moments that she had or those vulnerable moments that she had, it was hard to accept those when in the next breath she's like, here's my pawn of a son. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I liked her character, but I struggled with that aspect.
I didn't. I'll be honest. I think one of the other interesting aspects of Lady Danbury's character, which does fall into our third main character, Violet, the revelation that we had that Lady Danbury did indeed find some...
sort of love.
Well... physical affection after the death of Lord Danbury. And
that's a very proper British way, you know, to say that she had an affair.
She didn't have an affair.
He was married. That's 100% an affair.
He had an affair. She didn't.
I mean, that's still an affair, I would say.
She didn't have an affair. He had an affair.
I mean, most people would just say, like, the two of them had an affair, had a dalliance. Anyways, I liked your very British proper way of saying, what did you just call it?
Physical affection.
A physical affection.
Well, no, the reason I say that is because there's a quote here that we will talk about in just a second, where it isn't love. It is just purely physical affection, but because she had none of that from Lord Danbury.
Mm.
So this is something what I want to do is kind of, we'll talk through each of the characters and then we'll kind of pull it together into something that I started talking about right at the start of the episode, probably a part one at this point. Yeah, each of the characters have a different form of love in the series. And I think this is an interesting one to talk about because she had no love for Lord Danbury. Now, there was that one scene, if you remember, they were in bed and she turns around and she like cradles his face for a moment, which was quite tender. Mm. And you kind of think, oh, okay, so not completely physically repulsed by him, considering the age gap between them.
Maybe she was, but she's lived her whole life with him. She knows nothing else. So she had some sort of affection for him.
Yeah. Right. But it showed a moment of tenderness. But she didn't have any kind of like real connection. No, it can't say connection, but you know what I mean. And anyway, with Lord Danbury, and then after he died, she sees some of that connection with Ledger,
Lord Ledger.
We saw that it was a consensual relationship and that kind of thing. And so that was something that was very different for Lady Danbury. So one of the things that we did find in an interview with Arsima Thomas, who played the younger Lady Danbury, she said, and I'm looking down because I want to get it right, sorry. So she said, he's not really the love of her life. I don't think Agatha thinks in that way, because then she would have fought for him. If she'd been denied this love all her life and now here he is, she would have been distraught. It's less that he's the love of her life and he's maybe her first love, where everything is so joyful and devoid of complications, and then you drift apart, but it's still a very formative relationship. Lord Ledger turns up with Violet in tow on one of their rambles, which was a very covert way of saying, yo, we're done. It didn't affect her as strongly as it could have.
not all characters need to get married, that it was okay that she had had this journey where she'd gotten married when she was younger. It wasn't what she thought it was. And now she had had a bit of independence. But in between that time, she had this love story that, you're right, wasn't like the great love of her life. She found fulfillment in other things after that, and especially as an older woman. But that through this relationship, she was able to see that there is kindness and there is connection. You know, there's physical enjoyment. And she wouldn't have known that those things existed if her love story had ended with Lord Danbury. I think it was interesting, especially in the Regency era, one of the biggest ways for women to be independent was to be a widow. And a lot of women didn't want to remarry because the most freedom that they were ever going to have was by staying a widow. If you had money, if you were inheriting after your husband died, then a lot of that freedom went away when you married again. So it wasn't uncommon for women to just be like, I'm done. Thanks.
But we did have that slight exploration there. Again, it wasn't long enough to really delve into this properly, but we did have that moment where she gets in touch with the solicitor and asks about the inheritance. And there basically is none because Lord Danbury was trying to be a lord and didn't have the income for it.
Not surprised.
I would be quite interested to know what she actually did there, because it was after that moment that she potentially was going to pursue
Charlotte's brother.
So obviously the third main character, as we kind of categorize it for this series, was Violet Bridgerton. How did you feel about Violet's storyline?
Wah, wah.
Whoa.
I mean, Violet Bridgerton is maybe my favorite. No, that's wrong. Of course, Penelope. I'm sorry. I have misspoken. However, after Penelope, I love Violet because she's such a combination of things. She's gorgeous while she is an older woman. She's also youthful. She seems very cheerful and loving to her children, but she's also not a controlling, nagging mother. And so I've talked about Violet a lot on the podcast, and I think that it's such a well-rounded character. And then we get to this show, and basically there's a few scenes of her being like, I want to be gardened. We're shown her as a child. Those scenes are kind of useless to me. She seems like any other child. She's smart. Her father loves her. And then she meets her father's mistress. That's pretty much her storyline.
And then, but I think it does set up some things for her future quite well.
Yeah, and I feel like I thought that they would show more of maybe her marriage, but really they did that in season two.
Yes.
So I get why they didn't. I get why they showed her as a child and to make sure this all lined up with, you know, Queen Charlotte.
Timelines,
yeah, the timelines and stuff. I get it. But at the same time, I wanted more, and I felt like, yet again, Violet was a plot device. I felt like she was a plot device to help, yeah, mostly just Lady Danbury. I mean, so.
But let's be fair. This series was supposed to be about Queen Charlotte. The fact that Violet Bridgerton was in there at all was just cherry on top type thing.
Fine.
So we were never going to focus too much on her. And I think, though, this is something that I don't normally do. I don't normally read around the show in terms of, I don't normally look at interviews and stuff like that. But I did read something from an article earlier, how Shonda Rhimes was talking about Violet's father and the way that she created the father and why she did it.
Okay.
And basically, she said that she wanted to show that Violet had a good father, that he had a flaw, obviously. Cheating on your wife, bit of a flaw. So
you think? Bit of a flaw?
Which one of us is wearing our wedding ring?
That means I have an eternal bond with you, with or without my ring.
All right, like I don't believe you, but okay. So
you don't believe me?
No, you don't have your ring on.
We're not married if I don't have my ring on?
No.
Oh my god, you're ridiculous.
So anyway,
drama llama,
dear reader. So So Shonda Rhimes was talking about the fact that she wanted Violet's father to be a good father. And we did see that. And we wouldn't have if she'd been older and that kind of a thing. So I think that was pretty good. So obviously then that sowed the seeds for Violet finding Lady Danbury's secret. Was it a flower crown? Paper hat.
I'm just going to say, I've just thought of this. The absolute pettiness but amazingness of Violet, because sometimes she can be very like strategic, of her laying out those crowns literally all around that room. She could have put out one and been like, oh yeah, this is, you know, I actually saw one of these crowns from my dad at your house. And she could have just been like that. But no, she was like, I've put them everywhere. I want you to walk in the room and just be absolutely overtaken by all of these crowns that I've had through the years, so that you can feel bad about yourself and so that you know that I know about you.
I think it was a perfectly valid thing to do.
It was a very veiled kind of what I would call like silent British communication. I've lived in the UK for about 10 years now, and it is a real thing, this kind of silent British communication, where people do things like that, where you're not completely sure what people are talking about, but maybe they say it in a veiled way or a very polite way in an email or on a conference call or whatever. And I still struggle to kind of get the central message. I would have been the type to walk in there and go, oh, that's weird. I'm sorry that you're mourning, you know? A lot of period dramas especially show older women as being very matronly. We've talked about them being seen as a bit wise. Those things are not bad, but we don't often see older women as, you know, still wanting partnerships sometimes if they're widowed, or them wanting physical affection, those sorts of things. And I think Violet's story is this representation. Women of her age and her situation, she's lonely. She's almost probably about to be an empty nester. So she's going to be completely on her own. And she's realizing that even though she had this amazing love story with her husband, that she's lonely, that she misses that companionship. And she feels guilty that she feels that way. And Lady Danbury is a good kind of device to show her that you don't have to feel guilty for those things, that it's completely natural, especially for someone like Violet, who's lost her husband after such a long time, to want to find love again. I think it was nice to be able to focus on one of them in the present day who wanted to find love, because really we're seeing all three of these women as the typical older woman who is a spinster. And so all three of them don't have anything love-wise going on in their lives in the present.
We were talking about the three characters of Queen Charlotte, a Bridgerton story. And I think the interesting thing is that each of these three women are different representations of widowhood in a way. Because Lady Danbury had a not-so-fulfilling marriage and became a widow. Then Violet had a very fulfilling marriage and became a widow. And then Queen Charlotte has effectively become a widow because of the separation from George in his dementia and other health issues. Effectively, these are three different ways that older women in the Regency period are reacting to becoming widows. And I think that's a really interesting thing that we haven't seen before. I think that's really interesting. And obviously there's that scene in the church when Violet is mourning Lord Bridgerton on his birthday, and Lady Danbury's there. She says that Violet is fortunate, and Violet takes that the wrong way. And you know, and she's like, I'm sorry, how am I fortunate? My husband's died. I loved him very much.
I would feel that way. I would be the type to be like, excuse me, what do you mean I was fortunate? The love of my life is dead.
Yeah. But and in a lot of ways, the only reason that we as the audience know what Lady Danbury's talking about is because we've just seen the other episodes that show the relationship she had with her husband. So anyway, I think that was why we chose these three characters to be the pillars of our discussion in these episodes here, because there are other characters, arguably George and Charlotte were the main characters, just like the Duke and Daphne were in season one, and then Anthony and Kate were in season two of Bridgerton.
There are people that are obviously putting out memes of like George and Charlotte, which is so cute, and that is the main storyline. But I feel like in terms of the main themes of what Queen Charlotte is trying to attempt in telling us as a story, it's through these three women. It's through their stories and their different experiences of love, of marriage, of widowhood.
You know, we talked about having these history moments, and we've kind of been weaving it throughout.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
A little bit. But is there anything in particular that you'd like to highlight?
Biggest thing for me was that statement at the beginning. We've kind of mentioned it, but I wanted to read it again because I thought it was very interesting, especially for Netflix, because Netflix has had kind of a bit of a controversy to do with The Crown and the fact that there's been no statements on any seasons of The Crown to say this is fiction. And apparently some people have seen it as fact or thought that there was a lot of truth to it. And in some ways there has been. We have not seen The Crown, so we don't know. But certainly Netflix has had some controversy around that. So at the very beginning of Queen Charlotte, Lady Whistledown, I think that's a very kind of important thing, tells the audience, "Dearest gentle reader, this is the story of Queen Charlotte from Bridgerton. It is not a history lesson. It is fiction inspired by fact. All liberties by the author are quite intentional. Enjoy." And I feel like in a lot of ways, that is all period dramas have to do. We won't get into a discussion on should they not say this is fact, this is based on fiction, whatever. But to me, that set the stage for this entire series to go, oh, okay, this is the story of Queen Charlotte from Bridgerton. So we don't need to take it. And it says, you know, don't take this seriously, essentially. This is, you know, enjoy this show for what it is. I love history. I have a PhD in history. So I want to dive a little bit into King George III's real life, his illness that we don't know what it was, but what historians have speculated he had and how it affected he and Charlotte's marriage, the real George and Charlotte.
I think it's quite interesting because opinions have changed on the illness that he had.
Really?
Over the years.
Okay.
And part of that is based on how the contemporary historians viewed the sources that we had to kind of talk about it. So there were two things that have been floated as the illnesses. Now, originally, it was considered to have been acute porphyria. And you'll know that porphyria is also sometimes known as vampirism.
No way!
Porphyria is the real disease that gave vampires their beginning in modern myth, because it comes with a sensitivity to light.
Okay.
It causes like bloodshot eyes and things, and lots of things that became part of the vampire myth. But the main one is sensitivity to light. Also comes with neurological issues.
Okay.
Obviously, neurological being anything related to the brain, and similar in a lot of ways to how historically people would have been called epileptic for any range of neurological issue, for any kind of a fit or a seizure or anything like that. So porphyria did have some of those elements included. Now, the other opinion on the illness that he could have had was bipolar disorder.
Interesting. Okay.
And they essentially, there's different, as far as I'm aware, there's different types of bipolar disorder, and they can follow different patterns. Some cases, people will have the majority lows, which will then occasionally go into highs. Obviously, I'm talking about in terms of mood. So it could be a series of depression followed by a period of high mania. But then there are other cases where someone will have hypomania, which, if we're thinking like a graph, if mania is at the top and depression's at the bottom, and then the middle is like baseline, hypomania is halfway between baseline and mania. Obviously, in the show, he was portrayed as having periods of kind of normalcy where he doesn't have much affecting him. From what we can see historically, there were obviously the same kinds of things. As we mentioned before, they did have roughly 20 years of an ordinary marriage.
One of the historians, and we will put our sources in the show notes, but one of the historians was talking about the fact that it shook Charlotte so bad when he had one of his like first really big episodes, because her husband was such a man of like kind of upright character. He had basically, they were saying that it was such an altered version of himself that it scared her and she didn't actually want to be around him. And that's the sad part of the real Charlotte and George story, is that when he became very bad, she didn't go and see him kind of for the last 10 years of his life. She was terrified of him. His episodes were so severe and he was so not within his own mind that he could become violent, physically violent. So I think...
Well, as well, suspect that he did have dementia later in life. Now, what we also need to remember is that George III, prior to Queen Elizabeth II, was the longest reigning monarch, and in fact still is the longest reigning male monarch that Great Britain's ever had.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because he came to the throne at 22 in the year 1760, and he, as I said, in 1811, his son was made regent, but then he died, we didn't write that down, he died in like 1821, I think. 1822?
The 1820s, yeah.
Something like that. So despite the fact that he had that decade of the regency, he still was reigning at that time. And in fact, towards the latter years of his life, he was made king of Hanover, I believe, and wasn't aware of the fact because of his mental state and his health. So there were quite a few things wrong, really, that towards the end of his life, but he was, I think, 81 when he died, which was very old for that time
period. From the little I know of porphyria, they did find it in other distant relatives. So they believe that Mary Queen of Scots had it, and there was like two or three other people within that family line that also had porphyria, which is probably why they were saying that that's what it was.
Because it is a genetic
It is a genetic condition, but they're not really sure exactly what it was.
Nope.
You know, they are wondering if it's something that was genetic, because there was so much inbreeding with these royal families.
So obviously we've talked about the doctor a few times, and the historical physician was based on a real figure. So it was John Monroe. Basically, he ran the Bethlehem Royal Hospital, which, as it said in the show, it was also known as Bedlam, i.e. a place of madness. Monroe came from a family dynasty of so-called mad doctors, because they basically experimented on the mentally ill. And Monroe and others of that ilk actually had punters pay to enter Bedlam to see the patients.
What's a punter?
Oh, a punter is a customer.
Okay.
Yeah. Like a bloke that goes to the football. He's a punter.
I feel like I've heard that term, but I didn't know what it was. So, sorry.
So basically, though, he would get people off the streets to come through the hospital to see the inmates, the patients. They were
You know, it's midnight at this point. We have been filming for, 2.5 hours, maybe? But
they were effectively inmates.
Not inmates, but yeah, I mean, at that...
They were basically imprisoned, and a lot of them against their will. So yeah, but he would actually basically have a freak show.
And when you say freak show, there's no other kind of academic term for it than that.
That's the
legitimate term. That's what the academic term for it is. It feels like a very jarring term, but that's what it's called.
People would effectively put people with disabilities on show for people to see for money. So yeah, I mean, Monroe apparently came from a family that did that.
A whole family that did that.
That's what it says, a family dynasty. There's a lot of stories that revolve around the asylums at the time. Although I did see that there was a physician named Francis Willis who got involved with the king's care later in the king's life and was kind of known for a more modern approach.
You know, when we were watching it, you were like, I don't know if they'd be that extreme. And it seems like in some cases they were. So they were doing things like bloodletting or using leeches, using what some people would see as water torture, and these extreme measures, hoping maybe that some of these, the dispositions or something would come out of the person.
Yeah, because, I mean, they didn't understand the human mind. Mm-hmm. And as we said earlier, they were still, you know, talking about the humors of the body.
Yeah.
There was an unfortunate kind of incentive for these doctors, or so-called doctors, as we'd say today, to actually keep the king sick. Because we saw it in the show slightly. He was given very nice rooms in the house. So that was at Kew Gardens, right?
Mm.
Before they moved. At Kew was given a very nice suite of rooms, was being paid a lot. Our historical notes here say that they were possibly being paid three times the amount that they would normally get for a consultation. So they were incentivized to not heal people.
So I do have a small plug here. I did a video about a week ago on the channel that has to do with the water obsession in the Regency era and some of the medical practices during this time period, because some of them are really wacky, like I was saying, the bloodletting and things, but at this time they were really obsessed with water. So when they showed scenes of him being dunked in the water, that was very typical of the time. Everyone was kind of obsessed with water, obsessed with getting in water in different temperatures, obsessed with drinking salt water and goat's milk or crab eyes. There was a lot of interesting things that came out of this video that I've made. Some of them were about the royal family, actually. Charlotte and George's son, so the prince regent, when he became king, he had a lot of trusted royal doctors that were all around him. And I've made a short on that as well, where it shows there's this painting of him with a slew of men carrying all these like medical equipment bags and things, where he would travel with all of these doctors that he was paying handsomely, who were saying, okay, well, now you need to go to this particular seat to get, you know, the right kind of air. Oh, now you need to go to this bathhouse. Oh, now you need to go to do this or that. And they would, sometimes these doctors were incentivized by certain areas that were trying to drum up tourism for them to write papers or guidebooks or to recommend to people in society to come to this very specific place. Oh, the only place where you're going to get the best treatment is at Brighton. It's at Margate. It's at Harrogate. And so these doctors were now kind of seen as predatory because they were recommending very specific places or seaside air or, you know, these ludicrous treatments. And some of them were very legitimate, you know, trying to find cures for people. And then there was a lot of people, a lot of these doctors that were doing it for the money because they could be paid handsomely to recommend a place or to work with a member of the royal family. A lot of their kind of theories were not backed up by, you know, robust science. I mean,
how many of them were backed up by robust science?
But a lot of times with science, you know, obviously a lot of science is making mistakes and finding the right cure or, you know, theory. That's what a theory can be. Some of these practices were seen as, they were called, you know, quackery. And a lot of the pictures and images that I was researching for this video showed that term quackery was used a lot in newspaper clippings, in comics of the time period. These doctors were seen as untraditional and they were doing kind of crazy things to patients and making a lot of money doing it. So anyways, I recommend that if you'd like to learn more about kind of the water obsession of the era and kind of crazy medical practices, then I will put a link to that video now.
We'll wrap up the discussion here now, because this is probably going to be a two-part video, which we didn't quite intend.
No.
But, you know, it also, in the past, we've done an entire episode for a single episode of Bridgerton. We're moving away from that because it's...
we don't have the time.
Honestly, a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, yeah.
We hope that you have enjoyed this discussion, though. Please do let us know through the Facebook group.
We do have a Facebook group that I mostly post on, but people do get involved sometimes. Facebook.com/groups/Regency Rumors. And I'll put a link to that in the comments. Is that what you do on YouTube?
No.
On the description. I'll put a link in the description.
Although, actually, a lot of people will now do the top comment and they'll pin it, because apparently that gets views. I don't know.
We're too old for this. But but yes,
self-love.
Join the Facebook group. People can get in touch with us there. And then, obviously, please subscribe to this YouTube channel. And you can find all of our episodes on streaming services. All of your favorite ones?
Podcasts,
yeah.
Yes, we're not quite on Netflix with our own show yet. that would be fun though, wouldn't it?
Oh, the editing they would have to do.
I'm just glad I'm not editing this one. So, when we wrap up our episodes, we like to recommend another piece of media, if we can. And in this case, if you have liked Queen Charlotte, A Bridgerton Story, and Bridgerton, then you will probably love Sanditon, which you've talked about before.
Yeah, I've talked about Sanditon before. There's going to be a lot of crossover people that already know what Sanditon is. But if you don't, it's Jane Austen's last unfinished novel. And they just finished season 3 of that show. Is it very Jane Austen-esque? Somewhat, but I will say it's
that's a no.
I will say it's still a lot of fun. The romance is really good, and I feel like Sanditon does dive into some of the history of kind of colonization and has some very important lessons on race and things like that that Bridgerton doesn't even dive into. So Sanditon's a good show to check out if you like Bridgerton and you're going to be waiting a very long time because of the writer's strike for this next season. So, and then I'm about to get the Queen Charlotte book. I pre-ordered it. It's on its way. So I think it will be here on Tuesday, which is the day it comes out. And so I'll read that and probably either do a short or a very short video on my reaction to that and whether or not it's worth reading or whether or not you should skip it. It's written by Julia Quinn and Shonda Rhimes together. So it would be interesting to see what if there's any extra storyline in the book that's not in the series. I tend to be really bad if I've seen a TV show. I have a hard time reading a book. I would rather read the book first and then see the film adaptation. But I like it when there's extra things in the book that you didn't know about in the show or the film. So I'm hoping that there'll be extra things in there that will give us more information on Charlotte and George's relationship, maybe.
It'll be interesting if it's a novelization. Because if it's a novelization, typically they don't kind of work very well, in my experience.
Interesting.
The one novelization I've ever read kind of put me off all of them was for Star Wars and Episode 1, which, you know, obviously they're films first. But in terms of other books that you might like to read, which is somewhat vaguely not at all connected, but I've seen it on the shelf here, so I do want to point it out, is Legends and Lattes.
It's not related to Regency at all.
It's not.
Then you pulled it from my Regency. So we each of our like columns, these little cubes here, we have like different genres because we read completely different stuff. And so this is literally my Regency section that has all my Regency books in it. And he's pulled.
And I've not read any of those.
I don't know.
I've read this one. So no, but I think.
This is going off the rails again.
It's going off the rails. But listen, look, right. If you want something cozy, if you want something light, and you're looking for something different, Legends and Lattes has got it. It's actually fantasy, which is why I'm recommending
it. If you love it. Goblins and fairies and orcs, it's completely not within kind of like the demographic that would watch Bridgerton. But
it's about a coffee shop.
Very Bridgerton-esque.
But anyway, no. I just thought it was funny because it was on the shelf behind us for this entire discussion and
in the wrong section.
Yeah, exactly. It's in the wrong section. So I just thought I'd pull it out of the shelf there. But anyway, I really do hope that you've enjoyed the discussion for these episodes of Queen Charlotte. Forgot the name of the show.
A Bridgerton Story.
A Bridgerton Story. Thank you very much for coming along with us and listening and or watching. If you are new to the YouTube channel, please do like, comment and subscribe. That's the first time I've ever said that. It's very weird. And if you are listening to this on audio only, please do give us a review wherever you are getting your podcasts. That can help a great deal. And thank you very much for listening.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for listening. We normally say something funny at the end of these. Do you have anything funny to say?
Go read Legends and Lattes. It's a really good book. The second one's coming out, and I've forgotten what the second one is, but...
Goodbye.
Bye.